Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of And the Winner Is, where we take a look back at the Academy Award Best Picture winners. This time we're revisiting the 1994 winner, Schindler's List, directed by Steven Spielberg, released in the US on 15th December 1993, and in February here in the UK. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, Paul. Right, mate?
Yeah, not too bad. This is going to be an interesting one, I think.
Yes, I suspect it might well be, because, of course, this was a rewatch for me, I think. It was the first time for you, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
And so it's going to be, see, interesting how this is going to pan out. Just one or two quick facts for it, about the film. It was nominated for 12 Oscars and won 7. In addition to Best Picture, also won Director for Spielberg, adapted screenplay, the score, art direction, cinematography, and editing. So already, you can see, it was a sort of a bit of an Oscar darling. Interestingly, it was also up for Best Sound against Jurassic Park, which had been released earlier in the year, which was because Spielberg got two films out that year. We were spoiled.
Yeah. But now we get one about every 10 years.
Yeah. And as an aside to that, of course, this film, he was editing Jurassic Park in the evenings whilst he was on location in Poland, using sort of a couple, this sort of massive for the time setup of video and sound recording. Just that is crazy in itself. In addition to the Oscar, it also won 7 BAFTAs, including Best Film. Ralph Fiennes, who plays the Nazi soldier Amon Göth, gained about 28 pounds for the role by drinking Guinness. That's great to sort of put down on his tax return at the time when you have to buy Guinness. Now Spielberg apparently originally planned to shoot it in Polish and German with subtitles, but thought that it was going to be a little bit too much, and also that it would distract the audience from what they needed to be watching. I thought that was a fair point. It was adapted from the 1982 book Schindler's Ark by Thomas Kinnerly, which I think I may have read around the time. This was so long ago that I don't even have the book anymore, sadly. Originally, he wasn't going to direct, and he passed it around a few people he knew in the industry, like Martin Scorsese, and notably also Roman Polanski, who was a Holocaust survivor himself.
Yeah.
But he turned it down because he didn't feel that he could distance himself enough from it to be objective. And I thought that was interesting. The last little fact I've got here is that it was shot in black and white to give it a documentary feel. And you can see that in the look and the feel and the sheen of the film. It looks incredible. Budget wise, it was shot for $22 million. And what do you think it took roughly?
I reckon it took about $250 million, $250 million.
322 plus.
Not too far off then.
Yeah, that's not too shabby on a film which apparently thought was probably going to flop.
Yeah.
And where studios were reluctant to actually greenlight it because they didn't think it would do anything. But I saw it when it came out, and it tapped into a conscience at the time. I remember the screening I saw, it was absolutely packed. I think it was around for a few weeks. And just, it was one of those ones you had to really go and see at the cinema, I think, to get narratively to get the effect from it.
Yeah.
So as I say, this is one I hadn't watched those in full since its release, so it was quite interesting me going back to it after the best part. It's nearly 30 years ago.
What's going on? Yeah, very nearly.
So it's quite a lengthy film, so I think we may end up jumping around a little bit or trying to carve it up a little bit. So I just thought I'd get some of your initial thoughts on the sort of first. We looked at the first sort of segment in the sort of maybe the first hour, where before Fiennes turns up, and we sort of kick in from there. Some of your initial thoughts.
Yeah, to start with, as you just kind of mentioned, that a lot of studios didn't want to touch it, and I do feel it's a really strange release for Universal, who of course at that point were very much known for their popcorn movies.
Yeah,
that would be a family kind of film to go and see. Like we've talked about multiple films. In a similar vein, and it did seem strange that they picked that up. Obviously, being linked with Spielberg, though, a very strong connection with Spielberg over the years.
Yeah, but
it's not a surprise that Benjamin.
Sid Sheinberg had the rights for quite a while, I think, and he was sort of
schmoozing
Spielberg. And of course, like I mentioned, Jurassic Park. It basically was a bit of a horse trade in Jurassic Park made first to sort of get him on board for this one.
Yeah, and I said it's the second black and white movie that we've reviewed in as many months.
That's also modern.
Much removed from the black and white era. Mm. I also said I'm not always convinced that Spielberg makes the right choices through his career. He very much made his name for making blockbusters, and his more art house stuff has kind of never been seen as his best with the public.
There's a version. I mean, I'm kind of sort of something as a huge film fan. I sort of sit across, straddle the both, and I think some of his art stuff is fantastic. In a similar vein, Munich is another film I saw. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Well, enjoyed's the wrong word, but
yeah. On that note, though, I think this is one of Liam Neeson's best performances.
Yeah.
Because he's. Yeah. I don't know what's happened to him in recent years. I know, obviously, he lost his wife, but he's become very much playing the same character over and over again now.
Yeah. When you see him, from the first time you see him, you're captivated by him and drawn to him in this film. And,
yeah.
Because this was quite an early role for him after. I think he'd done Darkman maybe a year or two before.
Yeah.
And he did something with Next of Kin.
Yeah.
Patrick Swayze and one or two other familiar faces were in.
Yeah.
So he's still quite relatively unknown.
Yeah, not far after this, he obviously gets cast as Qui-Gon in Star Wars, obviously with the Spielberg link. But it was quite a surprise when he was cast in that, because he wasn't, as you say, Ewan McGregor was kind of the big name out of the two at that point. Neeson's career hadn't really taken off.
But this one did give him a good boost. Yeah,
his performances in this is superb.
There's one bit I noted from this opening, sorry, Kane, was True Lies. I'm not sure who wrote the piece, but it's the same piece that the function he's at.
Yeah.
Is the tango in True Lies, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I did say that the way it starts and really continues throughout the whole film, it kind of makes you feel like you should already know this history. They don't really dive into the history of what's going on particularly deeply. And for me, it's a little bit different because my great aunt was actually German and lived through the World War in Germany and escaped.
Yeah.
So I kind of know a little bit about it, but I feel if someone went in not knowing, and especially in this day and age where they aren't teaching World War II in history classes in school.
Really? That's just
difficult. Because it's not classed as history because it's too recent.
That's crazy. That's what I did at school, is modern history, actually.
Yeah. But I feel like if someone that was late teens, kind of that age that you would be watching these type of films, I feel they may struggle to coherently know what is going on for a lot of this film, which is a shame. But we'll go into it a little bit more as we go on.
Yeah.
I felt that the performances by Neeson and Kingsley are great, and we'll touch on Fiennes when we get there. But I don't think his performance is as good as Neeson and Kingsley, and I feel Kingsley's wasted quite a lot for a bulk of the film because he disappears. He's on the train. For a lot of the back half of the film, and it's kind of sad that we don't get to see more of a performance from him.
Yeah.
I did say it was probably quite a difficult set to work on because we know Kingsley and Fiennes have got really bad reputations.
But also, just the general mood, I think, was quite intense and quite tough. There was obviously not a lot of humour about on set. Apparently Spielberg used to go back and watch episodes of Seinfeld at night. And also Robin Williams rang him maybe once or twice to try and lighten the mood when he was back in his back in his house, in his apartment or whatever.
Yeah. The scene where he packs his wife off again, like she's only been there for a couple of days and he sends her off again.
Yeah, so I noticed he's got this very interesting relationship with his wife.
And
she's got a very sort of, I won't say open marriage, but she sort of because at this point, we see he's already got an eye for the ladies, and that almost comes back to bite him in the arse a bit later on, as we see. In a really awkward and intense scene, actually. Because she comes back and they sleep together, and he can't promise that she won't get treated by other than his wife. So she goes again. All right.
Yeah.
See you later.
Yeah, it's really like she just turns up for all of like a scene and then she's gone again. It's
played by Carolyn Goodall, who actually, I think, if I remember right, she was the pilot in Cliffhanger.
Yeah.
If memory serves.
Yeah.
I think it's probably the year before. It's just such an interesting sort of flip of characters that she played there.
Yeah. And at this point, I kind of wrote down that I felt it's another one of those films like Slumdog Millionaire that feels more like a documentary than an entertainment piece.
Yeah, well, I think that's very much that was one of his creative choices. I think, that's why he shot in black and white and photographed like.
Yeah, it's very much of a kind of a commentary on Nazi and Jewish relations than anything. The kind of bits that are interspersed are kind of don't really relate to the story much. Yeah. It's pretty much those bits where it actually talks about the history.
When it comes alive, its core theme is basically as simple as looking at the sort of examining the theme of good and evil. Where we've got quotes, a good German who he's not even interested in Germany. He's a Nazi party member because I think a lot of them at the time just joined for the prestige. Schindler's basically just interested in himself and earning money. And probably sees the war as just another way of sort of earning money. Whereas we then come across Goethe later on, who is just sort of a completely dark person.
A really
nasty person.
Yeah, and I said, I bet Fiennes didn't see that coming from a Nazi to playing Voldemort in the space of, 10 years?
Yeah.
His career took a very different path to what a lot of people would have expected.
It's quite startling. I'd forgotten him being young as a young actor as well. He's quite started seeing sort of quite fresh-faced in this as well. Again, he's not, because he wasn't an actor I was overly familiar with before this film at the time. Just one or two bits I want to pick up on there is at this point, of course, Schindler doesn't realise himself that he's going to become a good man because we see he's just basically out for himself at this point. There's just some wonderful little moments. Like I said, the strange bit with his wife. And we just get to the first bits of where Spielberg shows you the sort of how horrible it is going to be for is when they get stuck into those ghettos and it's horrible, horrible.
The bit that really turned my stomach was when they get off the train the first time. And all the luggage is there on the platform. And they said, we'll bring it. Don't worry. And it all just gets left there.
Yeah.
That was when you're like, here we go. These are the people that are going to be in trouble now for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. The possessions. Yeah. I'd noted that at some point, the luggage pile. Just all the possessions carved, tossed to one side. Yeah. It's awful. So that first sort of hour, it's quite, it gives us all the sort of the groundwork for the characters that we're going to come across and gives us who Schindler is initially. And we don't really see at this point any sort of indication that he's going to become the person who does what he does. So that's all quite well done, I think. I say, it's that strange, the one the standard is that strange relationship with his wife. Not quite sure what kind of a marriage they've got. But then, of course, we then get to the arrival of Armand Goeth, as we said, played by Ralph Fiennes. And are you really impressed? I thought he actually gives a really good performance in this film. We discussed in the previous record about Phoenix, Joaquin Phoenix. And it's very hard sometimes with these sort of characters, I think, because he's an SS officer, he's a Nazi, and they did some.
It's a very thankless task.
Thankless role, yeah.
Roles like, and he, this is my problem is that all he seems to be able to play, a lot of his roles are quite nasty. As I said, Voldemort, obviously, but a lot of the other things he does, doesn't play, he never plays a good guy. Yeah. And that's why I struggle, because he does just seem to play that role, which is rumoured to be how he is in real life. Obviously, not to these extremes, but, but by all accounts, he's not the easiest person to work with.
I think what is good about it is the little subtle bits and pieces. And so, there's a bit where they're building one of the I think it's a sort of just one of the camp buildings, and there's a Jewish architect, a woman who's sort of losing her shit over how they're building this place, and he gets involved and sort of comes over. And she shouts and tells him what's wrong with the building and stuff. And then he just so coldly orders her execution just because he can't get into an argument with a Jewish person. And then instructs his men to do exactly what she said afterwards. And I thought, you utter bastard, you know, because she was right, basically, but he because she was Jewish, he couldn't admit that.
Yeah.
And it's just, but the way he plays it is so, he's sort of this controlled sort of arrogance to him.
Yeah. So the bit that I now find hard, and I think Spielberg may have taken it just slightly too far, is when the Jews are being shot. It's quite graphic. And I know
once they get the order to shift them all out to camps and liquidate the ghetto.
Yeah, it just it feels like it went a little bit too far.
It's quite a long sequence, but for me, again, given the nature of the film and what it's about, I didn't really have a problem with that. I kind of feel we need to make these films, because apparently what pushed him to make it in the end apparently was a sort of the rise in sort of listening to and believing of Holocaust deniers, which is what spurred him at the time in the early 90s to sort of make this film. And I think it's all out there to see. He made it this way for a reason. Yeah. And I kind of didn't really have a problem with that. I think this shit happened. And those scenes stay with you. There's one scene where, to save bullets, they sort of line up about five or six guys in one line.
Yeah.
And he used one bullet to kill them all. And it's brutal stuff. But I for me, I don't, in terms of what the story was, you need to see that stuff. But that whole sequence, and of course, the reason it's there, it's the kind of first turning point for Schindler.
Yeah.
When he's up there on his horse with his partner or his girlfriend at that time, to actually see what's going on. And then we sort of focus on the infamous scene with the girl in the red coat.
Yeah, which I actually wrote down. It only takes an hour for her to appear. I was kind of expecting it to be a little bit later on in the film.
Yeah.
But no, they make that mark quite early on. At that point, it becomes more of a hard watch for me, because I just think it becomes very harrowing at this point. And it's kind of what's put me off the film is that I struggle with things that aren't going to entertain me. I'd much rather watch a film that's all right, but can keep me entertained and doesn't leave me with nightmares, than watching a film that's, I would say in quotation marks, a great film, but leaves me feeling bad about what I've just watched. And that's kind of what this film does to me. It leaves me feeling...
I can understand
feeling bad for watching it.
Probably be reflected in our summary.
I can
get that. I totally get that. So yes, from that point of view, I can understand that. But it's from cinematically, I think that sequence, I think, is important for the film. And that shit happened so bad. And but I say that use of the girl's coat was a really interesting sort of way, just to sort of focus his attention base as you see him sort of watching her wander across the ghetto, and then of course we don't see her again until a bit later on, and we'll get to that in a minute. it's basically, there's a sort of, the film kind of follows a little bit of a structure, I think, in terms of this. So we have the pre-Goethe stuff, so that then into the ghetto, then he arrives, and we're into the camp section, really, aren't we? So
yeah, and I did say at this point, Neeson and Fiennes are absolutely fascinating to watch on screen.
Yeah, yeah,
they're back and forth.
Yeah,
Just a brilliant. And again, that kind of reflects in my final score that the performances are superb. In a way, as I said, Fiennes, I don't like watching him. But what he does, he's good at.
Yeah. You can see this because he's obviously still there's that. This is the where we start to see the first sort of shift, of course, in him in Schindler, and he's trying to sort of get a feel for Goethe, and then we get a scene in a minute where he's trying to defend him to Isaac. Is that the accountant? But he doesn't seem to quite believe it himself when he's telling King's character about him being.
Yeah.
If he wanted wartime, he'd be a good man. But I don't think he quite believes that, what he's actually saying.
Yeah.
He's trying to convince himself of that fact still. He's still not quite tipped over to the man he becomes at the end yet.
Yeah, definitely. He's
trying to justify in his own mind, I think, the way things are, but not quite believing it. Because, of course, just before that, we've seen when sort of Goethe gets his house, what a shit he is when he just starts randomly sniping people.
Yeah,
such a git. It's just so casual. They mean absolutely nothing to him.
Yeah, it's just like I'm bored up here. I'm gonna take some people out.
Yeah, but Fiennes sells it so well. Just in his body movement and his stretching and putting the gun behind his. You just want the rifle to go off in his face. The other significant thing from this period is where we sort of see the sort of headstone road that they lay, and that's heartbreaking. So you're digging up all those graves just to take the bloody headstones to make a road.
My note here is talking about Fiennes again. As I said, he actually says Fiennes has a very refined taste. I find him pretty repulsive most of the time, but he does it well. And that's why I find him repulsive.
Yeah, yeah, because the characters, he sort of obviously consciously chooses these to explore these characters.
Yeah.
And he does do a good job when he signs on the dotted line. So it's hard sometimes to separate them, isn't it, from the character because they do such a good job, I think. And in this, he does a really good job. I think he got a couple of nominations as well on the back of it. But so, like, at this point, we sort of had that exchange with Isaac. I'm watching, thinking, Oscar, are you trying to convince me or yourself or Isaac? Because you know he's a twat, basically. We also then get a really good scene, I think, with Helen, played by Emma Davids, where she's telling him about the bones. And again, it's another heartbreaking scene, but it's also really well shot because you hardly see Schindler at all in the face. It's all focused in on her and just so well lit. That was one of the good things about the film as well, the way it's shot. There's always where Neeson's always shot more in the light than Fiennes is and stuff, just to sort of give you that separation again of the characters.
So
Spielberg does sort of, I won't say hold your hand, but he sort of sets things out for people that know film a little bit, I think, and stuff, and how it looks. Because I think this is probably the section with most of the talking, isn't it? This section as well, ironically.
Where it feels more of a documentary again at this point. It kind of feels like we've seen it in real life, and then they're kind of talking about it.
Kind of talking about power and what it means. And
again,
there's that great moment. You can see Neeson's character, Schindler, is trying to sort of rein him in a little bit by telling him basically that it's almost like the flip of the old Spider-Man adage about with great power comes great responsibility. But with the power, the bigger power is to not use it that way. And you can see Goethe tries it for a little while with the kid in the stable. And also there's another scene where the with a woman they're going to shoot, or a man they're going to shoot out the back and stuff like that. And you can see he's trying not to be a shit at various points in that little 5 minute sequence.
Yeah.
Until again, of course, the kid with the sink, I think it's a sink stain.
Yeah.
And you can see him watching stuff in the mirror, and you can see it just that 2 minutes of quote goodness is completely evaporated.
Yeah.
And then the kid gets shot out in the courtyard as you walk on. But that was, again, I think in terms of cinematography and stuff, and the way Spielberg sets it up was so clever. You see the two shots that miss him, but yeah. Then you hear the kill shot, but you don't realize it's the kill shot until Kingsley walks past him. And it's just heartbreaking to see that. And there's bits of his brain on the floor. And at this point, you're just willing somebody to off Ammon at this point.
And then of course we get the great line, good old fashioned Jew hating talk, which is just, it's just horrible. It's foul.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's said with such virality that it's like, no, I don't want to hear that.
But Spielberg captures the insane pride that they had in that sort of attitude.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And my notes kind of descend into how difficult I'm finding it at this point to watch. I said again, the lead performances are very good, but a shame Kingsley disappears into the background.
Yeah.
And I just said that I find it hard to make notes on the actual film rather than the historical stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
I want to talk about what's actually happening, what had actually happened, rather than what I'm seeing on screen.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult.
I've tried to take the approach as well of trying to look at it from a filmic point of view as well.
Yeah.
A narrative point of view, and some of the stuff that Spielberg throws in there, and so that's what works and what doesn't. Because then, of course, we then get, after a little bit of to and fro, we get to them sort of the ultimate solution. And the instructions come in that they have to get rid of most of them or get rid of them all. And of course, they're all facing a trip to Auschwitz, the ones that are left. And you get those little bits just before this where the women are putting blood on their cheeks just to try and appear fit and healthy with rosy cheeks, because they think it's going to sort of save them somehow. And then the children are taken away, and the lore is just a heartbreaking sequence as well. That is, the way that shot is perfectly done, the way that you see the kids waving to you, and then all of a sudden the adults just come swooping forward to the lorries.
Yeah.
It's just full, cinematically, it's just full of amazing little moments like that.
Yeah, it is. And that's where I will touch on that the documentary style works because of how it's filmed and things like that. It does. And that's, again, why I find it so harrowing, is because of how real it feels.
Yeah, yeah, I get that, totally get that. And of course, then as we then get to sort of towards the climax of the film, there's another sequence where he gets his list together. He manages to bribe the right people, and he manages to get Girth to commit to giving these people to him, effectively buying them. It's a great little scene with Kingsley where sort of he realizes that he's bought their freedom. And it's a great little moment between the two of them.
Yeah. As I said, Kingsley was superb.
Yeah.
Just would have liked a bit more of them, to be honest. Yeah.
We get this, and they're starting to sort of up and up now, the bits where Schindler's clearly becoming a better man, where the water scene, where of course they think he's using it to take the piss and to torture them.
Yeah.
And Girth thinks it's hilarious, of course, at first. And then, of course, just as the scene comes to a close, you can see in his eyes that he's starting to wander a little bit now. The effort that Schindler is putting into sort of to giving them their water and stuff. And as we're sort of racing towards the end, but we then, of course, get that, as I mentioned earlier, the sort of the once a little throwaway scene in which sort of where he's kissing somebody at his birthday party, comes back to haunt him with his sort of love of women.
Yeah.
And it's that scene when it's really uncomfortable in terms of not being, but of the ramifications. You think, oh, you really know that there could be some payback for this because they're non-people in the eyes of the Nazis. And he doesn't care.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then they sort of roll him up, they round him up and put him in that cell. And you think he was quite lucky there in some ways that sort of Goethe steps in and sort of saves the day effectively for him.
Yeah. But I was actually quite surprised at how long was left in the film after the end of the war. It seems like there's quite a big space afterwards.
Yeah, because well, we get to sort of back end of the war, aren't we, at one point as well, though, in this, because I think when they shift them all out to sort of Auschwitz, my history is right, it's the last month of the war when the Allies, the Russians are basically pushing in from the east, and the Allies are starting to sweep across now as well, so the order came in just to sort of liquidate everybody. So they were sort of, the Nazis were trying to push towards that as well. So we get to a point then where he finally gets them on trains and gets them off to send them off to Czechoslovakia. But of course, the men, and that's your first concern there, is where they split them up anyway. The men and the women are put on separate trains. And they, oh, this, I'd forgotten that scene actually in the first time around. And just down to a bloody paperwork error, and it becomes a race against time. And there's a scene then in what we think is going to be the gas chamber. I suppose it could be viewed as quite manipulative in some quarters, that it doesn't end like you think it will. But I think it's also in there as a sort of bit of, you get to feel the shared relief a little bit as well, that it hasn't played out like you think it was.
Yeah.
And they've actually had a bit of respite.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It does. There's, and I said it's very heartstring pulling.
Yeah.
At the end, it does come good in the end. Yeah. After all, we've been through, and I will give Spielberg that he did still manage to give it a happy ending some kind.
And I know. I think at the time, because we're getting onto the point now where the surrender's finally come as well now at this point, and there's that great scene where he calls all the guards and he calls all the prisoners into to the factory.
Yeah.
And I love that bit where he gives the sort of the Nazis that chance to sort of do one decent thing and bugger off, basically.
Yeah.
And they all, to a man, just piss off. And then we get the
release where all the soldiers come in and tell them that they can go, but basically tell them, you've literally got nowhere to go.
Yeah. Because just before that, we've had sort of the goodbye sequence, and that really is that really sort of powerful symbolic bit where one of them gives up his fill-in to make the ring. That's just a wonderful moment they put in there, just as that really symbolic sort of flip side of the teeth removal that went on in that time. To do this for some good. That last couple of scenes of Neeson's, I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to lie, I struggle to not cry my eyes out of the cinema. And I'm going to admit that it wasn't easy watching it this time around as well, because Neeson is so good in that sequence. And people have said it, I believe we're in... Some critics thought it was a little bit manipulative at the time, but Spielberg insisted it was needed as a way of the audience actually allowing the audience to mourn alongside these people. Because at the end of the day, we forget there are real people in this story, and these are real people. So it gives you a chance to mourn through him. And I'm just thinking about it now, it's quite an effort. Just the way he goes through and he starts counting the things that, like, the ring could have saved a person, or the car could have saved 10 people. And the way he just breaks down is so emotional at the end of it that he feels like he could have still done more.
He
saved 1,100 people.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is fantastic in that scene.
Yeah, as I said, this is, for me, probably one of Neeson's best performances. And just one of my notes was, why has he become so generic over the last decade?
Yeah, and watching the film, I had very much the same feelings. I sort of, so early, I think it's his only nomination to date as well, I believe.
Yeah.
in a career that's lasted 30 years since.
Yeah, exactly. It's tough to see someone's career go like that. And I know he's still got a great career, but even stuff like Ra's al Ghul still seems like the same character that he's playing in things like Taken and stuff like that. It's all just very generic, and it's such a shame because he did have such a great performance in this. As I said, the ending's very heartstring pulling. Great little section at the end.
This with the grave, which apparently wasn't actually originally planned. It sort of he had the idea about halfway through shooting, so they then had to try and track down any of the survivors for that sequence, the main one. As a producer or the production, that's not one you want to hear from your director, is it? Halfway through a film,
no.
Like that. Can we go? By the way, can we find anybody that's left and get them to do a scene where we shoot? Oh, geez. I think again, it's again just like the Neeson scene. It's a really moving and effective scene.
Yeah.
When you see
definitely
the actors come down alongside the characters they portrayed.
Yeah.
And then of course we get some people apparently thought Spielberg put the flower on at the end, but it's not. It's Neeson. You can clearly see that from the long shot.
Yeah.
And I think it's just a nice way to bookend it. Yeah. For me, I think you probably know I'm going to give this a really good score. It's visually, it's amazing. For me, the documentary style worked. Obviously, for you, it worked too well almost. Williams' score is really sort of emotional. It's not one of his old pop, 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 pop scores that we know so much. The Raiders and the Superman, stuff like that. It's very much the other the sort of lower ended sort of Williams. And it works so well. And that theme tune is so haunting. I think there's some nice sort of trickery in there. I said there's a couple of really good central performances. I said, like you say, a little bit, King's is a little bit wasted in terms of he doesn't really, also wasted is not the wrong way. He just doesn't have a sort of big scene in quite the same way, other than the one where he realizes that they've all been bought, their freedom's been bought. And for me, I think it's Spielberg's best awardee film by some way. It's his best serious film. And I don't think whether he'll even ever come close to it again. And I think it's one of his best films, period, as well. There's a lot of soul in it. It was a story that he needed to tell, I think. And for me, that I've got to give this 98%.
We're going to very, very, very much on this.
Well, because I agree that I said it's not a film you watch for entertainment. And now I've seen it a second time. I don't know whether I'll ever revisit it again. I've seen it twice and I don't think I need to. But purely as an best picture winner, worthiness of winning it, and a piece of film, I can't fault it really.
No. I am going to say I feel like I have marked it too low. So I am going to amend my score.
Mm-hmm.
Having talked through it, it's still nowhere near the heights of yours, but I just said it hits home a little too hard to find entertaining for me. It's still a really well-made film and has some great performances. But for me, it's not something. It took me a good 4-5 sittings to get through it. And I actually left a great big gap in between watching the first half and the second half. I watched the first half a good 3 weeks ago. Maybe even four. And it wasn't until last weekend that I actually watched the second half. So I really struggled. I originally wrote down 72, but I have upped it to 75 just because of what we've talked about throughout this, that I'm probably scoring it lower because of how hard hitting it was. But in some ways that should give it a higher score because it obviously worked. So I totally understand why you've got such a high score because you felt like it was what was required. For me, I'd rather be able to sit with a box of popcorn and just enjoy my way through a film. And I can't with this, but the performances, were superb. Cinematography was great. And as I say, possibly too good. To make it feel so real. So I'm going to give it a 75. out of 100.
I thought we probably would differ on this one in terms of what we kind of get from a film of this stature, so yeah. Understandable. I suppose at this point we should just find out what we're going to do for the next two records.
Yeah, so here we go. It's just running. I've just set it going. And the first one is 1989. So let me just go on the website. Let me find the category.
Rainbow.
And that is... 89 is, yes, Rain Man.
Yeah, it came out in 88. Yeah, okay, I watched that a few months ago, so that'd be interesting.
So let's set it going again. And it's given us a decade later, so 1999.
Oh. Shakespeare in Love.
Is it? Let's have a look.
I don't know.
It is Shakespeare in Love.
Well, so look at that.
You've two nailed both of them this time.
Two for two this time. Look at that.
So,
two very different films again.
Yeah.
I do like the fact that we haven't decided to do them in order because it keeps it fresh and we never know quite what we're going to get to do from week to week, month to month.
Exactly.
So it's good. I'm just waiting to get to some of them that are actually on my shelf. Out of the dozen or so that are on my shelf, I'm still waiting to watch.
So I have actually seen both of these films, so that's a first.
I have as well. I've seen Shakespeare in Love, and I've seen Rain Man a couple of times.
I think I watched Shakespeare in Love at school.
Wow.
I would have been doing my GCSEs. I would have just started them.
And of course, so there's another Fiennes in that, isn't there?
Yeah. Post Joseph makes his appearance in that one. So
right. Okay. Well, I suppose at that point, we should call it a day, and thank you all for listening, and thanks to you, mate, for coming on tonight.
Yep, no worries. I've really enjoyed watching those,
and we'll see you all next month. Good night.
Yep, cheerio.
This podcast is part of the After Dark Podcast.